This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the corner of the metaverse where you, me and the top experts get together to understand a big issue of the day. This week, what actually is number 10 and does it need fixing? The Sue Gray Report was not just about drinking. It also pointed at the nature of the operation at number 10. And although to many a discussion about this may seem an attempt to divert attention away from a current scandal, there are important questions to be asked about how the very centre of government operates. So, apart from being a building, what exactly is number 10? What does it do? And where is it failing? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, we need to understand how many people work at number 10, who they are, and ask who's in charge of who. Alex Thomas leads the Institute for Government's work on policymaking and the civil service. Before that, he was Principal Private Secretary to Sir Jeremy Hayward, Cabinet Secretary and Head of the Civil Service. Alex Thomas, when you were doing that job, where were you based?
So physically, I was in the Cabinet Office building, which is basically sort of just one up from Downing Street. There's a room sort of at the back of that building that is very close then to the number 10 link door, which does what it says on the tin and links with Downing Street.
So you didn't have to come out into Whitehall and through the gates and into number 10 Downing Street. You could always just do it the back way.
No, you can always go around the back. And link door passes are very prized amongst Cabinet Office staff because it means you can get into the heart of things.
And were you using your link door pass a lot?
Yes. Because you're one of the bridges between number 10 serving the Prime Minister and tilted towards the Prime Minister, and then the rest of the Cabinet Office, which has a slightly broader role.
What is actually the difference between what number 10 does and what the Cabinet Office does?
Number 10 is part of the Cabinet Office, which is a much broader organisation. And there's now about 8,000 people in the Cabinet Office. Its core job is to broker agreement across government. It's also the corporate HQ of government. It's got various kind of other policy responsibilities. But the Cabinet Office is a bigger organisation. Number 10 is one unit within it.
Who does the Cabinet Office report to?
Ultimately, the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister is a minister in the Cabinet Office, but there is almost always a minister for the Cabinet Office. At the moment, it's Steve Barclay, who's the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, and in day-to-day terms, they're the ministerial head of the organisation. The Cabinet Secretary, as the most senior civil servant in the Cabinet Office, also plays a very important role in leading the civil service side of things.
Culturally, is it seen as an elite civil service job? In other words, if you're a young civil servant, is this something you really, really want to do?
Yes, it's definitely a sort of career accelerant.
That's the Cabinet Office. Who is currently the most senior civil servant at the Number 10 operation?
So that's a man called Martin Reynolds, who's been much discussed, more so than I'm sure he would want. He's what's called the Principal Private Secretary, or PPS, to the Prime Minister. He's responsible for the civil servants in the private office, the policy unit, the press office, and runs the show on the civil service side.
Let's look at the political operation in Number 10. What does that consist of?
There's a Prime Minister's top special advisor at the moment, somebody called Dan Rosenfeld, who is the Prime Minister's chief of staff. They're not always called chief of staff. Sometimes there's more than one chief of staff. Under Theresa May's first year, Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill were joint chiefs of staff. And so they run the political side. Number 10 is unusual for a government department in that it has a very high proportion of special advisors, political appointments. And those special advisors work to the chief of staff, and they do some of them similar things to the civil servants, but from a political perspective, because Number 10 is both a political operation and a government operation. So those are the people who are giving the Prime Minister advice on his political position and his political agenda rather than the operation of government. But it is quite important that government advice and political advice is kept separate. And then ultimately it goes up through the Principal Private Secretary and the Chief of Staff to the Cabinet Secretary, who, if there's a fundamental disagreement, it's part of the Cabinet Secretary's job really to be able to kind of broker that and allow everybody working in the Cabinet Office and Number 10 to come to a kind of consolidated position.
Would you say that the lines of authority are always clear?
No. I think part of the problem with the current Number 10 is that they might be sort of particularly difficult to follow through because of the style of this particular Prime Minister. Number 10 is operating in a political environment and in a government environment, and it is quite hard to draw very sort of distinct lines of accountability and authority on an organisation chart.
Who appoints who in Number 10?
The Principal Private Secretary is a civil service appointment. They work for the Cabinet Secretary and are appointed through a civil service process. But as often happens with civil servants who work very closely with ministers or the Prime Minister, there's often a sort of personality chemistry test between the minister and the civil servant. So while the PPS is a civil service appointment, it's very important that they're someone who the Prime Minister is comfortable working with. The Chief of Staff, or the top special advisor, is absolutely a prime ministerial appointment. That's an appointment that is in the gift of the Prime Minister, and that's much more sort of straightforward in that sense.
Just give me an idea of the physical layout here. Where are all these people in relation to, let's say, where the Prime Minister and the Prime Minister's direct office is? I mean, because you're talking about a fairly large operation, so I imagine someone can be fairly physically distant.
Yes, it's a few hundred people, which is small compared to other government departments, but big given the size of Number 10 and the Downing Street estate. Different prime ministers have worked in different places. Most recent ones have worked in the study. Then there's a private office which sits directly outside the Prime Minister's office. So they're the gatekeepers, if you like. The private office is mostly civil servants, but any chief of staff or very senior special advisor worth their salt wants a seat right outside the Prime Minister's door so they can control access as well and be able to pop in and out of the Prime Minister's study. And then beyond that, the sort of warren of Number 10 going up into the attic space of Number 10.
You've worked there. If you were to design a building for this particular function, would you design it as Number 10 is now set up?
No, but isn't that quite often the way? It's been the centre of government for so long that it's actually very hard to sort of strike it all out and start again. Prime Ministers want to live in Number 10. They want to operate from Number 10 because of the status of the building, but absolutely not. If you were designing a setup, you'd have a far more kind of open and modern and less confusing setup than the physical buildings in Downing Street.
And Alex, who set the organisational tone when you worked at Downing Street?
In Number 10, definitely the Prime Minister, and I was closest to Number 10 in Theresa May's time, and that very much set the tone. You know, Theresa May working in the first year of her time in office, particularly with Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill, and then after that with Gavin Barwell. And I think those groups of people set the tone. And in the Cabinet Office, the tone for me, because I was his Principal Private Secretary, was strongly set by Jeremy Hayward as the Cabinet Secretary. So those two people, Theresa May and Jeremy Hayward, were the two, for me, who really set the tone and the expectations of behaviour.
Do you mean it could be a bit like an experience in an old Roman baths, which is that you could be moving from working in the frigidarium and the cold chamber and then walk into the warm chamber?
It's one of the things about the UK system of government that power can transfer between prime ministers very, very quickly. And I think that does pose an organisational challenge in that one day you're working for Theresa May and the next you're working for Boris Johnson. Two more different characters would be hard to imagine. Number 10 moulds itself so closely to the style and approach of any individual prime minister. And the objective of civil servants is to gain the confidence of the prime minister as quickly as possible. And so they need to be quite good at turning on a halfpenny. Perhaps, though, that very flexibility has led to some of the problems that Sue Gray's identified in her work.
Alex Thomas. So how and why did the present setup evolve in the way that it has? Andrew Blick is Professor of Politics and Contemporary History at King's College London. Andrew Blick, could you take me back to what we know about the office of the Prime Minister in its earliest incarnation? What was it doing?
In the early 18th century, the time of Sir Robert Walpole, who's commonly regarded as the first Prime Minister, actually, a lot of the things were in some ways recognisable today. Things like trying to coordinate ministers within the government into some kind of coherent policy programme. Also, what we would now call managing the media, getting favourable coverage in newspapers, pamphlets, these kind of things.
Was Number 10 always a home as well as a workplace?
Not every Prime Minister has lived in there. Most of them have used it as an office, and many of them have lived in there. If we're looking for the constants, that's another one of the near constants in the history of this office. So there's this blurring going on, and often Prime Ministers have members of their family working for them, or they have people who've been companions or political allies of theirs for many years in there working for them as well. And the whole history of the Office of Prime Minister, very informal. If we go back to Walpole days, the term Prime Minister was actually a term of abuse. You accused someone of being a Prime Minister. No one would admit to being a Prime Minister. He denied in Parliament that he was a Prime Minister because it was seen as being a mark of someone who'd become too powerful. So the office originally was disavowed even by those who held it. That meant that actually having an official staff attached to an office that didn't exist was a problem. So it's an informal development. And the first occasion on which we actually get what could be seen as a private secretary paid out of public funds working for a prime minister is in 1806. And it's gradual growth from there. I think one important change comes when David Lloyd George becomes Prime Minister late in 1916, and he introduces some quite important changes, expands the size of the Prime Ministerial staff, gets in a team of advisers that look a bit like the policy unit of later periods, and also creates what becomes the Cabinet Office to provide support to Cabinet and some support to the Prime Minister as well. So that, I think that's a big change in the kind of institutionalisation and growth of the Prime Minister's office then. And then through the 20th century, it gets bigger. But even now, it's not officially a full department. It's not like the White House.
When did the first special advisers arrive in Downing Street?
Special advisers, as we know them, really begin in 1964 with Harold Wilson. He gets into power after a 13-year period of opposition for Labour and thinks, well, there's a civil service here who have been working for a succession of Conservatives and now they've got to work for me. Perhaps I need some of my own people. The other context then as well is that this was a time in which people were being very critical of a variety of different social institutions, including the civil service. And a criticism of the civil service was that they haven't got the expertise that's needed for the job. We're in a kind of period of economic decline. We're collapsing as a world power. We don't know our role. We need people who actually know about economics, who know about how to revive the country. So one of the things Harold Wilson wanted to do was bring in some economists. That's when really the special advisor experiment begins.
How many did he bring in?
There were about six across government as a whole, and about three of them were working for him in the Cabinet Office on Number 10.
Now, Mrs. Thatcher, what did she do about special advisers when she came into Downing Street?
When Margaret Thatcher first came in 1979, part of her agenda was what you might call a smaller government. So initially, there's actually a reduction in the number of special advisers at Number 10. So Harold Wilson and then James Callaghan during the 70s have been expanding the number at Number 10, you know, up towards, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, that kind of thing. Margaret Thatcher gets in and cuts it right back to 2 or 3 initially. The most important one was probably John Hoskins, who was head of her policy unit. She later recruited the economist Alan Walters, who was another kind of controversial figure who we, you know, some of us will remember well from the time, but has a smaller number. But then over time, actually starts to find them useful, and we see the number creeping up again.
So how many are there now?
There are in the low 40s now, I think, on the most recent count.
When does the chief of staff role emerge?
The big change there is in 1997 when Tony Blair gets in and he wants to bring some of his own people with him. And one of the people that Blair brings in with him is Jonathan Powell. But Jonathan Powell comes in and is made chief of staff and actually holds that post for 10 years throughout the Blair premiership. So that's quite an important moment.
Would you say that Jonathan Powell had the same role under Blair as Dan Rosenfeld has under Boris Johnson?
I think that's a slightly difficult call to make. I think the thing with Powell was this, that when Blair became Prime Minister in 1997, he introduced a legal instrument called an Order in Council, which said that up to three special advisers working for me in Number 10 have executive powers. Now, this is the only time this has ever happened with special advisers. The idea with special advisers is that they are there to advise and assist ministers or the Prime Minister, but not give orders to civil servants. But Blair waived that rule and said up to three advisers are allowed to give orders to actually run the machine, to actually manage the system. And that's the only time that those formal powers have been given. And Jonathan Powell was one of the recipients of that particular power. The other one was Alistair Campbell, his chief press secretary.
Was that Blair innovation kept to by subsequent prime ministers?
When Gordon Brown took over from Blair in 2007, one of the things he does on day one to differentiate himself from Blair is revoke that order in council. You know, there, at the time, there were all these various controversies around sofa government, around the Blair style of government being too presidential. So Brown wants to get some kind of distance between the style of Blair and his style.
Which is interesting, because if one's reminded of the term sofa government, one is reminded of the fact that the informality element within Number 10 is always subject to criticism.
Absolutely. And Number 10 is an informal environment. In many ways, Number 10 is designed to accommodate the particular style of a given prime minister. So although you do get continuity, when a new prime minister comes in, there will be people who served the previous prime minister. It's not like, say, the US, where a new president gets in, thousands of people leave, thousands of new people come in. The idea is that every prime minister will have their own particular working style and they'll approach things differently, and Number 10 tries to accommodate them. Certainly that's the nature of the office, is that it is flexible, that it depends on the person in the job, what they want to do, and also the circumstances.
Andrew Blick. It should be clear from his account of the evolution at Number 10 and Alex Thomas's explanation of its current structure that certain tensions and contradictions are baked in. So can they be baked out? And what would you lose if you tried? To discuss that, Patrick Diamond, Associate Professor of Public Policy at Queen Mary, University of London, and before that he was also at 10 Downing Street, where he was Head of Policy Planning, and Jill Rutter, Senior Research Fellow at the think tank UK in a Changing Europe, and also a former civil servant. Patrick Diamond, one recommendation from the Grey Report is that there should be a permanent secretary at Number 10. Would that be an innovation?
I think the way in which the Prime Minister is talking about the role that the permanent secretary would play would be an innovation, in the sense that it's an acceptance that there needs to be more formal accountability and oversight of how the Prime Minister's operation is working in 10 Downing Street.
So have we had permanent secretaries before?
We have had permanent secretaries before, but the way in which the Prime Minister spoke about this on Monday suggested that he wants the Downing Street operation to resemble something more akin to a Prime Minister's department, that is, overseen by a permanent secretary with more formal systems of transparency and accountability for the operation.
Now, I hate to put you on the spot here, but what actual difference does it make? What would a permanent secretary be able actually to do that doesn't happen now?
A permanent secretary would be a formal link of accountability between Number 10 and Parliament. So the permanent secretary could, for example, appear before a select committee and would be able to justify, for example, the spending or the personnel decisions that were made in Downing Street. But of course, you can create formal structures, but it's the behaviour of the Prime Minister that will ultimately shape outcomes. So however good a structure you create, if the Prime Minister doesn't want to be bound by formality and structure, then it's going to be very hard to change their behaviour.
Jill Rutter, if a permanent secretary is to be effective, and we've heard some of the limitations on the possible effectiveness, what actual powers would they need to have?
I think if you were going to do this job in these circumstances, you would need to get pretty clear assurances from this Prime Minister that he was going to allow you to enforce standards and behaviours across the whole Number 10 operation, not just the civil servants in Number 10, but also the political and press operations, to make sure that all those requirements laid down in the Civil Service Code, the Ministerial Code and the Special Advisor Code were being observed at all times. I don't think anyone would want to take on this job without those assurances from the Prime Minister.
In what form would assurances like that actually come? I mean, if the Prime Minister says, would you come and do this job, and you'd only come in and say, OK, but I want a written set of assurances about what it is I can do and how you will respond to what I do.
That's more or less what I think I would insist on if I was going to try to do this job. It's a very unattractive job, as specified at the moment. If you're going to be responsible for sorting this out, you need to make sure that the Prime Minister is absolutely behind you. Uniquely in all of government, the tone of Number 10 comes very much from the Prime Minister. But I'm just not sure that the civil service feels it knows enough to tell Prime Ministers, actually, we've been around a long time, you haven't, this is how you govern well. And maybe the civil service needs to discover the confidence to do that.
Patrick.
If you look at recent controversies, for example, the high-profile departure of some senior permanent secretaries in Whitehall, then it's not difficult to suggest that having a permanent secretary in Number 10 isn't going to do a great deal of good if they fear that if they speak out of turn, they speak truth to power, to use the rather cliched phrase, they're going to be fired by the Prime Minister. So I think the climate, the culture, the relationship between the Prime Minister and their respect for the civil service is very important if any of these changes are going to make any real difference to how we're governed.
How far does the Prime Minister bear the imprint of Number 10, and how far does Number 10 bear the imprint of the individual Prime Minister? Jill?
Number 10 definitely bears the imprint of individual Prime Ministers, but Prime Ministers also have to realise that, you know, they are Prime Minister, they have structures around what they have to do. I think the thing that really, really surprises them when they come into Number 10 is how different it is from every other job they've ever done. And in particular, just how big an amount of time they have to take up with foreign affairs and things like that. So they come in with one conception of what being Prime Minister is, and I think they leave with a very different one.
Patrick.
Prime Ministers tend to come into Downing Street having very little sense of how government works at the centre. It takes them a long time to learn how central government works. In that sense, it is the case that Downing Street is imprinting on them rather than them shaping Downing Street. But on the other hand, over time, because of the lack of checks and balances and the relative absence of formality, they can restructure Downing Street and the Number 10 operation pretty much in the way that they feel most comfortable with.
Now, I suspect, Patrick, we're going to come back to this problem and this dilemma in a moment, but you gave evidence that the Public Administration and Constitutional Affairs Committee's inquiry into the role and status of Number 10 last year about whether or not operations there should be formalised, whether there should be a creation of a department of the Prime Minister. What do other countries do?
Other democracies that have strong similarities to the UK, I'm thinking here particularly of Australia, to some extent New Zealand and also Canada, all have operations at the centre which are larger and more formalised than what we have in the UK. So there's a sense in which they have modernised their systems of government at the centre in a way that perhaps Britain has been reluctant to do.
And why did they do that?
They did it in part, I think, because there was felt to be a need to have more formality and structure and oversight, accountability to political institutions and so on. But I think more than anything, because there was a feeling that they wanted to increase the capacity of the centre. They wanted their systems of government to have capabilities at the centre that enabled them to get things done, to see through policy, to implement policy in an effective way, to try to meet the priorities of voters as effectively as possible.
Let's look at the pros and cons. So, Jill Rutter, what would be the benefits of a department of the Prime Minister?
I think the benefits are that a Prime Minister coming in would be given more capacity to sort of both shape but also implement their agenda. What we've seen is that when new Prime Ministers come in, they come in sort of with quite a sort of naive view quite often about the sort of slimmed down operation that they're going to bring in. But over the first year, year and a half in office, they become increasingly frustrated that for some reason the rest of government isn't following their priorities, and they reinvent bits of machinery, whether it's a delivery unit. Boris Johnson last year reinstated a delivery unit. David Cameron abolished the Blair Brown delivery unit, then reintroduced it. or they decide they've got to build up some capacity for longer-term thinking. And they're a bit frustrated. They come in, they see their colleagues with big departments, and they think, well, I'm Prime Minister, and I've got virtually nobody working for me, and I'm having to sort of recruit them all and scrabble them together from scratch. So I think, as Patrick said, it's a bit outmoded.
Yeah, the problem at the heart of this is whether or not that kind of fluidity is a good thing or a bad thing, the capacity of prime ministers to make up their minds and maybe change their minds about what they want from this system.
I think fluidity is good. They'll want to reshape it, but I think there should be more of the sort of basic core capacities there to start off with that they can then put their imprint on, because we do see this repetitive cycle. And we don't reinvent every government department when people go in. You don't sort of say, hello, Chancellor, how would you like to run the Treasury?
Patrick Diamond, what do you see as the disadvantages of a Prime Minister's office?
Well, there's one clear disadvantage which draws on what Jill just said, which is that it'd be much more difficult to shape the operation around the needs, the style, the personality of that particular Prime Minister. So there is a potential disadvantage about inflexibility. The virtues of the British system of government are that you can adapt it according to the needs of a particular Prime Minister. I think another potential problem of having a big Prime Ministerial operation, call it an office, call it a department, is that it would reinforce a trend in British government which has been endemic over the last 20 or 30 years towards centralisation. We try to run policy and implementation through a command and control centre. Is that a healthy way of running government? Is it a good way of delivering policies in the modern world? That's a questionable assumption.
Now, what you've been talking about is the need for whatever function grows up in Number 10 or sits in Number 10 to reflect the needs, and this is a quote, personality and style of the Prime Minister. Can I make the suggestion? It may be obvious why it reflects the needs of the Prime Minister. It's not at all obvious to me why it should reflect the personality and style of the Prime Minister, Patrick.
Well, the Prime Minister obviously needs to be able to operate in a way that they're comfortable with. Prime Ministers come in different forms. They have different leadership approaches. Some Prime Ministers favour an approach to government in which they give a lot of leeway to other cabinet ministers and to departments. Others, frankly, want to be more controlling. They want to have more oversight. They want to centralise more. And we've seen prime ministers approaching the job in both of those ways, and they've been effective. So there is an argument to say that the operation in Number 10 should reflect the leadership approach of the Prime Minister of the day. Of course, there's a case against that, but there is also, I think, an argument in favour of it.
So very quickly, just on this, Jill Rutter, Department of the Prime Minister, yes or no?
I think probably yes, ultimately, but I don't think it's the answer to the questions that we've been discussing all week.
Okay, and what about you, Patrick, yes or no?
Yes to a Prime Minister's office with more formality, but it's not going to solve Boris Johnson's problems.
Jill, do you think that the present scandal has fundamentally weakened the office of the Prime Minister as an institution?
I think at the moment it's brought the office of Prime Minister into disrepute. I think, you know, in sports we have this charge of bringing something to disrepute. It looks like a chaotic and shambolic institution that's a bit insulated and out of touch with what's going on in the rest of the country. And that's not a good place for the leader's office to be.
And would a change in structure help them get out of that situation?
I don't think a change of structure is the obvious answer. I think that was a bit of a lifeline provided by Sue Gray to the Prime Minister.
Patrick, what do you think?
It's very unlikely that the recommendations in the Gray report are going to fundamentally change the current Prime Minister's operation style of leadership, because they seem very clearly embedded. That said, if we have a proper debate about whether the UK government does need a proper Prime Minister's office or a formalised Prime Minister's department, that would be a good conversation to have. I think there's been too little discussion about this issue. To some extent, these are kind of kicked into touch as issues because they don't seem terribly pertinent to the politics and big issues of the day. But actually, you know, all the big issues, the cost of living crisis, dealing with the foreign policy crises in Ukraine, dealing with issues around energy prices, all of these issues are going to be better dealt with through more effective government. And that means having, in my judgment, more structure and more formality around Number 10.
That was Patrick Diamond with Jill Rutter. And my conclusion is that I don't have an easy conclusion. Rigid structures create cleaner lines of responsibility, but they restrict a Prime Minister's ability to govern as he or she sees fit. Informal structures risk chaos, arbitrariness, and ethical hazard, depending, of course, on the Prime Minister. My thanks to Alex Thomas, Andrew Blick, Patrick Diamond and Jill Rutter. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Ben Carter and Rosamund Jones. The programme was mixed by Rod Farker and the editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon. And if you enjoyed it, you may find other episodes interesting, including Should We Be Scared of Inflation? Might There Be War in Ukraine? And What Are the Options for How the BBC Should Be Funded? You can find them all on BBC Sounds.